Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cara, acne can be tough. Whether your kid is just starting to get breakouts or has been struggling with them for years, there's a great product that can help.
Phyla is the ultimate game changer. It tackles acne right at its root cause, rebalancing the skin's bacteria and packing it with probiotic phages.
Phyla harnesses the superpowers of probiotics, tiny warriors targeting and wiping out the acne-causing bacteria. In studies, Phyla slashed acne-causing bacteria by a whopping 90%.
Phyla doesn't just fix acne you can see. It stops new breakouts in their tracks. It has no harsh chemicals and won't irritate or dry most skin. Phyla's three-step system is like a dermatologist-approved magic potion. Cleanse, apply serum, and moisturize twice a day.
As a special treat for our listeners, you can grab 25% off your first order of Phyla. Head over to phylabiotics.com, enter code PUBERTY at checkout, and kickstart your family's journey to acne-free skin. Check out the link in our show notes for quick access.
Hi, I'm Cara Natterson.
And I'm Vanessa Kroll Bennett.
And we are obsessed with flipping puberty positive.
Puberty is a stage of life best described as a roller coaster of physical and emotional shifts. It happens to literally every human being on earth. And it shouldn't be cringy. It should feel, you know, pretty comfortable.
Which is why we started this podcast and a newsletter, and why we film slightly ridiculous but informative social media videos.
It's why we have a brand that makes clothes that literally feel so comfortable, and why we write books too. Our latest is This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained.
We have built a universe of puberty positivity, and it all started with this podcast.
We are so happy that you're here. We're releasing this episode on World Autism Day, and we know and hope that our interview with Dr. Donna Henderson provides people lots more information and foundation for understanding how to care for and support autistic kids, whether they're living in your home or they're in your community or in your life. Our guest, Dr. Donna Henderson, has been a clinical neuropsychologist for over 30 years, and she has written a couple of books with co-authors Dr. Sarah Whalen and Dr. Jamel White. One is This Autism, a Guide for Clinicians and Everyone Else? And the other is This Autism, a Companion Guide for Diagnosing?
This episode covers general and specific topics across the autistic spectrum. We talk about definitions of terms. We talk about shifts in diagnoses and treatments. We talk about the medicalization of autism and then the unmedicalization of autism. Donna shares her own journey through caring for kids with autism, going from a place of really not being very interested because there wasn't a lot of information, to finding deep joy in working with this community and then discovering autism in her own home. It's a beautiful conversation, but also an extraordinarily helpful conversation, which at the end of the day lands in a very interesting place. So many of the tools that adults can use with autistic kids are identical to the tools that they can use with kids who do not carry the diagnosis of autism. Listen and enjoy.
Dr. Donna Henderson, thank you for joining us on the Puberty Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So we got to you through our friend, Debbie Reber, from Till Parenting. And the reason that we so desperately and eagerly asked her to connect us with you is one of the biggest questions we got on the road in front of 55 schools and thousands of parents was, how do we support neurodiverse kids through puberty? And is puberty different for kids who are neurodiverse? And we did an episode with Debbie where we talked about some of that stuff, but it was a very 30,000 foot episode. And today we're going to talk to you specifically about autism and the intersection of autism and puberty. And I think if we could start, Donna, with you just sharing with our listeners a little bit about your expertise and how you come to be an expert on this particular topic.
Sure, happy to. So I'm a neuropsychologist. I'm not autistic myself. I'm an ADHDer. And I had absolutely no interest in autism. I got almost no training in it in graduate school. It intimidated me. Just didn't particularly interest me. So I avoided it for the first part of my career. And I found a lot of other mental health clinicians avoided it. So that sort of normalized it for me and made it feel like it was okay, even though it wasn't. And at a certain point about 15 years ago, I realized, wait a minute, I can't avoid this. I need to understand autism. And I started to gradually learn it wasn't just me, that it's a problem in the mental health field, in healthcare in general. So many people didn't get enough training on this. So I learned more and more, particularly about autistic people who camouflage and aren't recognized as autistic. And I started doing it because I felt like I should. And I fell in love with it. These just ended up being my favorite clients to work with. It felt like really fun and interesting and meaningful work. And so I eventually decided to write a book, which evolved into two books with my co-authors, Sarah Wayland and Jamel White. And through this, I also learned I have some autistic people in my own family.
You talked about camouflaging. The definition has also changed and morphed and evolved over the time from when you weren't interested until you fell in love with this topic. Can you help people understand the terminology a little bit and what was meant by the term in the past and what is meant by the term now?
Yeah, I very, very roughly think of camouflaging as when your inner experience doesn't match your outer behavior. People think sometimes that camouflaging is a conscious choice, and like they could tell somebody, well, just, you don't have to camouflage with me, just stop. But autistic people who grow up camouflaging all the time don't always realize when they're doing it. They can't necessarily start and stop at will, although sometimes to some extent, they certainly can do that. And we all of us non-autistics can relate to this, but we don't have to camouflage nearly as much as autistic people do, but we can vaguely relate to it. When you camouflage, you may stop behaviors that would feel natural to you. So you might want to be rocking during a conversation and you force yourself to not rock. That would be camouflaging. And it also could be forcing yourself to engage in behaviors that don't feel comfortable to you, like making typical eye contact, forcing yourself to do that. And it's all in an effort to fit in and to not be noticed as different.
So when we talk about, when we use the word autism or autistic people, some people might be sitting there thinking, I thought I was supposed to say people with autism. Have I been saying it wrong? Am I using it wrong? I thought I was supposed to use Asperger's for some people and autistic for other people, right? Like the language and the definitions and the sort of respectful vocabulary has evolved rapidly. And can you help us, Donna, understand what autistic people would prefer personally? And again, this is, it's sort of a dumb way to ask the question because I'm creating a monolith that's composed of many, many different human beings. So can you talk about like what sort of considered acceptable or respectful language? Where are the pockets where people may choose different things? Like we had Jessica Leahy on recently to talk about addiction. And she's like, The accepted terminology is substance use disorder, but I call myself an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. That's how I refer it, right? So can you give us a sense of what that landscape is like in terms of vocabulary?
Yeah. So there is no one right way to talk about any of this, because like you said, we're talking about, you know, I don't know, 140 million people worldwide. We're talking about autistics, and they all have their own preferences. So when you're working or talking or living with an individual, you ask that person what language they prefer, and you use that language, of course. On a grander level, there is sort of the medical model, which is person with autism. And many of us in healthcare sort of grew up with that medical model. So if somebody has diabetes, you don't say the diabetic, you say the person with diabetes, because diabetes is a disease and it's categorically bad, and nobody in their right mind would choose to be diabetic. You know, there's nothing good about it. And so you want to put the person first, and note that the person is separate from the disease or the disorder. So historically, that is how autism was talked about, particularly for autistic people who have really, really high support needs, and their parents would talk about it that way particularly. But now we have so many really bright, late diagnosed autistic people who say, I don't see this as a disorder at all. This is just part of who I am. And they often prefer identity first language, autistic person, and capitalizing the A there, capital A, autistic person. So that's identity first language. So because that's the population I tend to work with, I tend to use identity first language. So up until 2013, we diagnosed autism spectrum disorder separately from Asperger's, separately from something called PDD-NOS, mm-hmm. which stood for Pervasive Developmental Disorder, not otherwise specified, but which we informally called, psychologists didn't decide, or PDD, or physician didn't decide. It was sort of for these instances when somebody was felt to be kind of sort of spectrum-y, but the clinician wasn't comfortable making a call. So there's a lot of people with that PDD-NOS diagnosis that sort of falls under the autism umbrella. But in 2013, it all got combined into one diagnosis, autism spectrum disorder. So that's all we have anymore. However, if somebody was previously diagnosed with Asperger's and they want to call themselves an Aspie, yeah, of course, have at it.
Okay, so it's always fascinating to me to see where the vocabulary shifts. So pregnancy is not a disease, and yet the medical model calls pregnancy a disease, right? So much in the same way, we have so many physical and mental health challenges or obstacles or just paths that get diseasified. And there is a big push, I think, everywhere within healthcare and outside of healthcare to undisease them, which is happening in this field as well. And your follow-along thought about when this diagnosis becomes a badge of honor, a part of someone's identity that they want to say, I am autistic with a capital A, because there are a lot of strengths that come with having this brain type. And so I think that's a good place to start the conversation about being labeled as either autistic or being a person with autism and being in puberty, because the spectrum is massive and the experience of these kids and these families along this spectrum is massive. And so maybe we can start with just something very simple, like as Vanessa teed it up, are there any common threads that seem to weave through this population vis-a-vis puberty that parents and caretakers and educators and healthcare providers and coaches and mentors should be thinking about? Is there any sort of top level way to approach talking about puberty with someone whose brain type is consistent with having autism?
Yeah. So big questions.
Big.
Yeah. So you sort of asked two questions. I heard one.
I asked like 12, maybe.
I'm narrowing it down to two. I heard two. my ADHD brain weeded out the rest. So it's sort of like, what is the experience maybe of a lot of autistic kids in puberty? And also, what should parents and teachers know in terms of supporting them?
Yeah, it's basically the entire rest of the episode is what Charlotte is asking.
So and we've got 4 hours, right?
And we've got four days, Donna. It's great. So I would love to start inside the body. Like, I want to know, in your experience working with autistic kids in puberty, what's your understanding of their experience in puberty that might be different than a non-autistic person's experience going through puberty?
Yeah. So a few things come to mind. One is there can be a lot of sensory differences, right? People know about sensory sensitivities. One sensory difference that people seem less aware of is interoception. So I grew up being told we have 5 sensory systems, but we actually have 8 sensory systems. And one of those other 3 that people don't think about is interoception, which is your ability to sort of perceive and understand and interpret what's happening inside your body, particularly in your organs. And that helps us know our homeostatic emotions, like, am I hungry? Am I thirsty? Do I have to pee? Am I having a sexual urge, right? That's part of this. And interoception also helps us understand our affective emotions. Am I getting annoyed? Am I rageful? Am I a little sad? Am I super depressed? You know, what are all my feelings? As we know, people who are going through puberty have lots and lots of feelings. And we can't manage those feelings if we don't understand them, if we're not perceiving them in typical ways, and we can't label them and talk about them. So if somebody has altered interoception, either too low, where they're not perceiving or, you know, understanding the signals, or even too high, where every little signal can feel overwhelming to them, that can make it more challenging than typical kids to go through puberty. So that's one thing that comes to mind.
Donna, can you just share the other 2 in that bucket of 8? So we've got the basic 5 are smell, sight, hearing, taste, touch.
You got it. Yep.
Then there's interoception. What are the other 2?
Proprioception?
Yep. You got it. Should we tell your listeners what proprioception is?
Please, because my definition will suck. Yeah.
I don't know that mine's much better, but it's knowing about the parts of your body, your hands, your legs, your arms, your fingers, you know, what they're doing and where they are. So if I hand you a glass of water, I intuitively know how high to raise my arm and how much force to push forward with. If I'm climbing up and down stairs, I intuitively know how high to lift my legs. You know, my daughter who has proprioception differences tripped on stairs till she was like 18 years old. And it was sort of a family joke. It was just amusing. She never hurt herself or anything. And it took me forever to realize, oh, that's a sensory difference.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it as like your sense of yourself in space, like in the outside world. So like I have 2 kids who, when you walk down the street with them, always veer in front of the other people they're walking down the street with, because they're just like not aware of themselves in space in relationship to other people. It causes like a lot of really pleasant arguments amongst my 4 children as 2 members of our family are cutting off the 2 other members of our family. So that's always really, really fun.
In puberty, proprioception shifts because your body is physically changing size and you often don't know where you are in space. I mean, you grow, your hands and feet grow first, then your legs and arms, then your trunk. And when you have those big hands and feet and those long legs and arms, but your trunk is still smaller in proportion, it can be very hard to navigate around the world. So there's a That's
so interesting. Donna, what changed at 18 that your daughter stopped tripping on stairs?
I think she just sort of, you know, her nervous system developed to a point where, you know, her proprioception just, you know, improved enough, or she had enough practice going up and down stairs. But Cara, I never thought about it that way before, what you just said. And that's really interesting. And it also made me think social expectations change around that time too, as far as personal space. And, you know, how close you might stand to somebody or how you may or may not touch somebody or be touched by somebody, it changes around the same time. So there's a lot happening there.
A lot.
I keep thinking about also the hugging. Like, and I don't remember if when we were teenagers we did this, but today's tweens and teens do so much hugging. Like, yeah. It's so fascinating with each other, with adults. Like, I'll meet kids, friends of my kids, who I literally am meeting for the first time, and they'll reach out for a hug. And I'm like, okay, like, if you're okay with it. But it's so, the tactile, you know. And also, I mean, kids are constantly, like, you think about preschoolers constantly touching each other and pulling on each other and playing with each other. And it sort of seems to happen all over again in this puberty stage. Donna, is it both awareness of how you want to be touched and also whether or not other people are welcoming your touch? Is it both those considerations for autistic kids going through puberty, or do you find one way or the other seems to be more of a consideration?
More of the kids I've worked with, they are uncomfortable being touched by other people, even moving down the hallway in middle school and being jostled by others. Most people don't find that to be pleasant. Right. But for us non-autistics, we can blow it off pretty quickly. It's not a big deal. But for a lot of these autistic kids, that might be enough, or being hugged by even a friend unexpectedly, mm-hmm. that might be enough to put them in neuro crash for the rest of the day. Hmm. Right. And not be able to shake it off.
Crash. That's a term I have not heard before. Neuro crash.
I love this term. It was coined by an autistic man named Ron Kaufman. And I think of it as a more grown up word for meltdown, you know?
Oh, it's
and
so a great when, word.
Right. It really mm-hmm. is. Because, you know, a lot of these kids who are going through puberty and older, everyone older, people who are autistic, especially, you can be in sensory overwhelm. You can be in social overwhelm. You can be in overwhelm from the flexibility requirements of your day. And then your nervous system gets to a point where it's like, I'm done, right? And that's, you know, neuro crash.
What's the third? I don't think we got to the third of the...
The last sentence.
It was bothering me too.
I know. I was like, we're going to finish this podcast and we won't get to the third. Okay. So before we cut you off again, Donna, what's the third one?
It's vestibular functioning. And that is more about your trunk and your head and knowing, you know, if you're upright, if you're spinning. So kids who get car sick easily or crave being upside down all the time may have altered vestibular functioning as opposed to the parts of your body.
So that's very interesting, because one of the sort of stereotypes, old school stereotypes of someone with autism, a young kid with autism might be a kid who is literally spinning, right?
Yeah.
In space. Yeah. And yeah. Is that because their vestibular reflex, their vestibular, how would you phrase that? It's there.
It could be. Yeah. It could be vestibular sort of seeking or craving behavior for sure. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Absolutely. I also think of it just under the general category of stimming, which right. can be either sensory craving or some kind of repetitive behavior. The repetition feels good.
Vanessa, we literally have 3 minutes to eat lunch every day. I am not joking. And the challenge is how to make it delicious and healthy and still fit into that tiny window. Our answer is Factor's ready-to-eat meals. They have been a godsend.
We throw our Factor meals in the microwave. It takes 2 minutes and out comes a gorgeous, fresh, never frozen meal. We both love the tamale vegetarian one. It's delish. There's a ton of options every week. There's 60 add-ons, breakfast, snacks, beverages. I love doing the wellness shots with my kids. They think it's hilarious, and I know they're getting vitamins and minerals in their bodies.
So get meals on your table or at your desk in 2 minutes or less. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning. You can customize with flexibility to get as much or as little as you need, and you can press pause or reschedule depending upon your lifestyle.
So to order, go to factormeals.com/puberty50 and use the code puberty50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That code is puberty50 at factormeals.com/puberty50 to get 50% off your first box, 20% off your next box. And I am going to go do that right now because I need more Factor meals in my refrigerator. Cara, lately I have been lying awake at night. I'm physically exhausted, but I can't sleep because my mind is so wired with everything going on between work and my family. So I've added Magnesium Breakthrough to my nightly routine, and it actually helps calm my mind. It helps me get better sleep, and I wake up feeling better rested. I'm less cranky, and I'm more patient with my family and with you.
Oh, I've noticed. And it's because, unlike other magnesium supplements that might give one or two formulations of magnesium, Magnesium Breakthrough has seven. That's why you're sleeping so well and waking up refreshed. Now, dietary supplementation is always best, Vanessa. So that means eating your minerals and vitamins is the best way to get them in. But if you can't or you don't get enough, Magnesium Breakthrough is the way to go. It can also help digestion, though too much helps your digestion too much, which is not a good thing. It can support muscle recovery, so bye-bye, Charlie horses. And it helps build dense bones, which is especially important for women approaching and in menopause.
We have an exclusive offer for our listeners. You can go to buyoptimizers.com/puberty, buyoptimizers.com/puberty. And you can use the code PUBERTY10 during checkout to save 10%. That promo code is PUBERTY10 at buyoptimizers.com/puberty. Your body and brain and family and business partner will thank you.
Cara, my kids love Magic Spoon cereal. And even though it's cereal, they actually love it as a homework snack. The variety pack has four flavors, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. And fruity is the favorite flavor in my house.
Now, this pack has 0 grams of sugar, between 13 and 14 grams of protein, and between 4 and 5 grams of net carbs per serving. It's made with wholesome ingredients, no artificial flavors or dyes, and it's high in protein, gluten-free, grain-free, and soy-free. So a great choice, Vanessa.
You can go to magicspoon.com/puberty to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our, you guessed it, promo code PUBERTY at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident you're going to love their product. It's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they will refund your money. No questions asked. They do not want you to send their cereal back to them.
Try a bowl of Magic Spoon cereal today at magicspoon.com/puberty and use the code PUBERTY to save $5. We take this group of kids who, most of whom share interoception differences, right?
Many of them do. Yeah.
Many.
Yeah.
And then some vestibular, some proprioceptive, although there's a big Venn diagram overlap between people who don't have the diagnosis of autism and people who do, and all these different sensory issues,
yes.
Right? And now let's apply that. Maybe we can focus on interoception a little bit. Let's apply that to your body is changing. Like it's physically right. Shifting.
Right. Yeah.
So can you walk us through how a parent or caretaking adult might best engage a kid in conversation about their changing body when there are enough challenges as it is when kids are able to access their sort of their awareness of how their insides feel? Most kids, regardless of whether they carry the diagnosis of autism, don't have words for it until they are getting older. So that's a hurdle. But how does one help a child who is struggling to figure out how they feel internally with a deeper understanding of what's happening internally?
Yeah, it's really challenging. One thing I would say, I find myself telling parents all the time, stop asking so many questions that are really hard for your kid to answer. Like if you're constantly at like, how did that feel? How do you feel about that? Does that feel good? And if your child is constantly like, I don't know, fine, like not giving you my, like some of that might be teenager, right? But if your child is neurodivergent and has low interoception, then it's like you're saying, what color is your breath today, honey?
That's an excellent.
That's what it's like for them.
By the way, this is great advice for caregivers
Everyone.
Of all kids. Yes. Like, I remember when one of my kids was little, and like he was language delayed, and the therapist was kind of watching me interact with him, and she's like, just stop asking him so many questions. And like, why are you asking a question? And then another question on top of it, another, like, just give him a break, give him a chance to like think and answer. And it was the best advice ever. Yeah. And so I think this advice, Donna, it's like, what color is your breath? That would be an amazing poetry prompt.
Amazing question.
So instead of showering them with questions that they may or may not be able to or feel comfortable answering, what is another way to help build that granularity, that awareness, without kind of backing the dump truck up on them?
I'll say two things. One is not necessarily helping that directly, but is so important, especially for these kids. And that's remembering that there are two nervous systems communicating with each other when you're with your child. And it's one thing to be aware of the words that come out of your mouth, but it's just as important, if not more important, to be aware of your own nervous system and to just have a peaceful nervous system to whatever extent you can cultivate it, and to lend that to your child, right? And when you are on edge and you are anxious, to try to be aware of that and manage it, or separate from your child for a little while if you can, because your nervous systems are constantly connecting and sharing things, and anxiety is contagious, calm is contagious. So just keeping that in mind is one thing. And the other thing is, and I cannot stress this enough, it's true for every kid, but especially for our neurodivergent kids, validation. It is unbelievably important. Our neurodivergent kids get invalidated all the time, inadvertently, right? By well-meaning people. You're so sensitive. It's not that loud in here. Why didn't you say hello to them? Why can't you be more social? Like, just we tend to talk like that to our neurodivergent kids, and it invalidates them. And it's like tiny little traumas all the time that add up. And so, first of all, stopping that to whatever extent we can, which, you know, we just have to try our hardest, but then to validate their experience. We're drawn to people who validate us. And if you validate your child, then after they are going through puberty and they become like full-on adolescents and young adults, they will see you as a safe person to come and talk to. They will take counsel with you. They will tell you what's going on in their lives if they see you as somebody who's validating. So you are like, it's like putting money in the bank for later on.
So what I'm hearing is the advice that we give parents across the board applies very much to kids with autism, which is being quiet, zipping it, and validating are keys to not just future open communication, but also to not being part of these little micro traumas that they carry with them.
Right. Absolutely. And as the parent, I'm sure you've had the same experience I've had, where there are moments in parenting where I have no clue what to say. Like, I know I'm supposed to say something, but I don't know.
Oh, Donna,
what.
That never happens to us.
Never. Okay. It must just be me. And here's the trick. In those moments, validate. Lead with validation. Say what you're seeing. Wow, I see how angry you are. I can feel your anxiety right now. And boy, I'd be feeling angry too if I was, you know, seeing the situation the way you're seeing it. I promise it will never lead you wrong to start there, you know?
I'd be angry too if I was my child. Donna, I want to speak for a minute because you touched on it earlier, and I'm honestly really curious, and I think it would be helpful for our listeners. We talk about crushes, and we talk about desire and urges and lust and sexual curiosity, and I'm curious about how does that play out for kids who are neurodiverse? Is there a discomfort or fear about it? Is there a way to explore it? Like, as kids are getting comfortable or not in their bodies, and there's new urges and they're in new dynamics with other people. What's your understanding of how we can best describe and support kids as that side of their development happens?
Yeah. So, I mean, neurodivergent kids can run the gamut from, you know, typical feelings and ways of expressing them to very unusual feelings and ways of expressing them. So, just I'm going to give you two examples that I commonly see. One is in these low interoception kids, they may be having very low urges for sexual or romantic interactions. And so, you know, I don't know if you've heard the term aroace, aromantic, mm-hmm. asexual, you know. So when I hear somebody's aroace, it's possible they're not autistic, of course, and somebody can be aroace for a variety of reasons. But autism crosses my mind as a possibility. Maybe they have low interoception and they're just not feeling many different feelings very strongly. And sexual urges is just one of many, right? And the other is not about sexuality, but about gender identity. So for some of these kids, they don't particularly feel masculine or feminine if they're not feeling a lot of things, and or they may not relate to the social construct of gender and not even understand what the heck we're even talking about with masculine and feminine. And there's a term I love called audigender, A-U-T-I, like autism, hyphen gender, audigender, which basically means I can't separate my gender from my autism. I'm not cis, I'm not trans, I'm just me.
That is so fast. So the research tells us that there is a disproportionate number of autistic people who identify as non-binary or transgender. And like the research, as with all things around gender identity, is rapidly evolving and emerging. But we were so struck by that when we were writing the book. And I'm so happy to hear you kind of illuminate what may be the underpinning of that and illuminate it in a way that is joyful and based in like a sense of pride and identity, as opposed to like, oh, well, now it's two problems. It's that right. You're describing it as the opposite, which is like, this is who I am. And these are the ways who I am come to inform my understanding of myself in the world. And I love that read on it.
Is it a version of introception? Is it that there's just no desire to label that sort of internal feeling, or is it separate from that?
I personally don't associate body gender with interoception as much as not relating to the social construct of gender.
Yeah.
But I don't know, in part because I'm not autistic and in part because this is also new.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I appreciate about this part of the conversation is helping reframe for people things that have traditionally been seen, and you talked about this earlier, Donna, as a problem or an issue or something to be fixed or dealt with or treated. And as someone who works with autistic people, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how the world is changing in terms of like that perspective on treating or fixing things about neurodiverse people and ways in which we're like, no, this is who I am and how I am, and I'm going to move in the world as my authentic self, and I don't need to fix it. Can you share with people a little bit about that? I think it's a shift in thinking. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah. Oh, it's a big shift in thinking. I mean, it's not happening fast enough, you know, but it is happening quickly, and it's very exciting to see. You know, when I was in graduate school and even for years after that, the idea was, oh, if you diagnose autism, that means you send somebody for social skills training. And the goal was to make the person look less autistic, to teach them, for instance, to make what they would call good eye contact, as if eye contact could be good or bad, right? It, you know, and now there's a shift to it. Once we understand somebody's autistic, we think, well, how can we help that person live an authentic life while being functional in the world, finding balance, right, with the world? So I don't, you know, regularly send people to social skills groups, for instance. I would much rather they're in a group with other, for instance, late diagnosed autistic people, sharing their experiences, processing their trauma, comparing notes on how to disclose, all of those kinds of things.
in the world of pediatrics, the way it was always taught was about mainstreaming. So very similar concept. The goal being that kids get mainstreamed back into classrooms where they are able to thrive with all the other kids. What's the philosophy there now? Where have things shifted?
I don't know if I can answer that because school systems are all so different, and there's public schools and private schools. And even here in the DC area, you know, there's just a tremendous variance.
I don't have an answer either. And the reason I ask is sometimes when we look back through the retrospectoscope, we think, okay, that was horrible. What we were doing was just, I can't believe that was our social policy, our healthcare policy, or whatever, right? And it's just cringy. In this case, I do think that there was a real concerted effort to do right by people whose social sensibilities were different in an effort to, this is what those social skills classes were all about and mainstreaming is all about. Like, how can you help people come into the fold so that as they get older and individuate and become independent and all that, they are like rolling through life and everything's hunky-dory. And there's a balance between that and honoring who someone is at their core and sort of recognizing there are lots of different lives to live. I think this is one that it feels to me 10 or 20 years down the road, we're going to look back on what we're doing now and have questions there too, because it doesn't feel that there is one right answer for, first of all, there's no one type of person who fits into this category. It's a very, very diverse group of people. And so there can't be one right solution. And does that add up?
100%. And for me, it's not that, you know, historically, all the onus of responsibility to change was on the autistic person. Non-autistic people weren't doing the changing, right?
Yes.
But we also, it's not practical to expect, well, the whole world is going to change and that autistic people can fully be their authentic selves all the time. So can I share a personal story that relates to this? So at my dinner table, on my side of the table is me and my youngest. We're both non-autistic ADHDers, the ADHD side of the table. And the other side of the table are my two autistic kids who are 25 and 23. My husband sits at the head of the table. He's not part of this particular story. So one day my ADHDer was telling a story. And my two autistic kids who are, you know, just to give you a snapshot, like my oldest is in a PhD program. My middle one is in college and they're out there in the world doing what they need to do. Anyway, so she was telling a story and they weren't making any eye contact. They were looking down the whole time while they were eating. And as a non-autistic person, that felt disrespectful to me. So after a few minutes, I said, hey, autistic people, how about some eye contact over here for the non-autistic people? Because that's how we talk in my family. And they laughed. And then they put me in my place, rightfully so, by saying, we make eye contact out there in the world because we have to, and we're good at it, but we hate it. Why should we have to do it in our own home? And they were right, of course. They shouldn't have to do it in their own home. But also, that doesn't mean I was wrong for wanting eye contact.
That's right.
There's no right and wrong. And it's about having these open, respectful conversations to try to find something that works for everyone. And that's what I want for the families of the autistic people, you know, for your listeners, parents, just to be able to have these conversations.
So Donna, how do we foster that in our families where we don't have autistic people, in families where we maybe have a situation like yours, where there's a whole buffet of folks sitting at the sitting at the table? Your husband will, I'm sure, in another podcast episode, his diagnosis, my husband always says, like, everything that my kids have all comes from him. He's like, you have nothing and I have everything. And I'm like, just waiting for the day to save the money to do his neuropsych, because they'll be like a month with him. So can you talk about how we can both foster empathy and understanding for autistic people without making our kids feel like they're walking on eggshells and can't be kind of authentically curious and engage in conversation. Like I always feel, we had this conversation with an expert we had about gender identity, like people are so afraid of messing up and saying the wrong thing that it becomes like a barrier to having really healthy exchanges. How would you recommend people go about that and sort of developing that in their own families?
Yeah, I think we think of it like a bank account. You have to make deposits into the bank account of trust and build trust, being genuine and being open to when my kids called me out on my eye contact comment, that I wasn't defensive in that moment, that I was internally, I didn't want to accept that. That was not like a proud mommy moment for me, but that I could be non-defensive and say, and consider their point of view and say, you know what, you're right. I didn't think about it that way before, which is hard to do. It's hard for any of us to do, to be non-defensive in those moments, but to be able to pause and do that then signals to the other person next time they can bring it up again. Yeah. And so we can have that open conversation. And my co-author and dear friend, Sarah Whalen, always says, meet difference with curiosity, not judgment, mm-hmm. right? And so when anybody in your family or your world is behaving differently than you behave, or behaving differently than you wish they would behave, to not lead with judgment, but to start with curiosity. Like, I wonder what's driving that. Mm-hmm. I wonder what's behind that. And trying to ask them with authenticity, you know?
Every podcast, no matter what the topic, it boils down to being curious and leaving your judgment behind. This is such an interesting moment in the conversation to recognize that a lot of what we've talked about is different from what we normally talk about. And yet all of the advice is the same. All of the approaches are the same. All the tools in the toolbox are the same. It's right. There's a universality to how we approach kids whose brains and bodies and hormones are transforming. And it really doesn't matter where they sit on the neurological spectrum. Kids are kids, and zipping it, listening, being curious, not having judgment. All of these are the tricks of the trade that we as adults can bring to the conversation.
Donna, I would love for you to finish us off here with how people can talk to autistic kids about body changes, about emotional changes. You know, I'm thinking about like how many euphemisms we use in sex ed or in relationship conversations, that I'm wondering if that's like not an effective way, idiomatic language. Like, right. What are some kind of guiding strategies for people caring for autistic kids that may need to do things a little bit differently?
Yeah, I'll give you a few. And that's a great point right there. Autistic kids do best with very direct communication, unusually direct communication. You have to just say it very, very clearly. Don't beat around the bush at all. Don't require eye contact when you're having hard conversations or awkward conversations. And that's probably true for all teenagers, but especially true for autistic kids. Not sitting across the kitchen table where eye contact is sort of expected, but taking a walk, which is amazing because there's repetitive behavior, there's access to nature, driving in the car, just places where eye contact isn't necessary is really helpful. And making it clear, there's no question that's off limits, except I always had one rule with my kids. No question is off limits, except if it's about me and daddy. Right. Not going to answer any questions about me and daddy. Outside of that, you can ask me anything in the world. And they did ask me some pretty wacky questions at times. And sometimes I was shocked or I felt awkward and had to quickly hide that, you know, in order to signal to them like, that's a cool question, you know, and they were cool and interesting questions.
Can I interject a question about that actually? Because one of the techniques we recommend to people is when you get a question and you're not sure where it's coming from, we recommend people saying, oh, that's so interesting. Like, what made you think of that? I'm wondering if that question works, is successful. Is this a successful strategy for autistic kids, or if somehow that sort of like puts them on the spot in a way that might feel uncomfortable? Like, what would your if you're shocked by a question, is that something that would work?
I think that it just depends on the kid. There are some autistic kids that you absolutely could ask that of, and others that, you know, you can't, and you have to know your own child and how defensive they are and what kind of communicator they are, and do some trial and error if you're not sure.
And what about, you know, we know that people with disabilities are at higher risk for sexual abuse and predation. And I'm wondering, with respect to autistic kids and prevention of sex abuse, same strategies, are there additional things that you would recommend people employ to help keep their kids safe?
You know, besides sort of obvious things, the one I really highlight with parents, again, I hate to sound like a broken record, but the more you are a safe person, the more you validate, the more you signal, you can say anything in the world to me and I will not be shocked. I will not judge you, because what we want is for these kids who are at high risk of not just sexual victimization, all kinds of victimization, right?
Yeah.
To tell us, their parents, when something is happening, when something's out of the norm, when something doesn't feel right, to keep those lines of communication open. And this is, I'll go bring it back to interoception. This is especially true with these low interoception kids, because when you think about times in your life when you felt unsafe in some way or yucky, it was a feeling. It was that inner alarm that vaguely told you, like, this isn't right, get out of here. And if somebody's not getting those internal signals and doesn't necessarily have the social relationships, like the friends to go to confide in, then they really need that open communication with their parents.
It's such a good point. And every one of us has had to learn how to be in touch with those internal signals. You know, this concept of instinct, it is partially inherent and is partially learned. And what you're talking about is just a steeper learning curve, right? You just, the learning looks a little bit different, but your point that if someone is already socially isolated in part because of their autism and they don't have that peer group, it is ever more important that they have people, trusted people to go to who they can, once they've identified this feeling, they can share this feeling. And I think that that's true for every kid across the board, but ever more important in this community.
Donna, is this a place where it's not necessarily social skills, but sort of educating autistic kids on like signals to look for and some of the skills in terms of safety? Like when you say all forms of victimization, I assume you mean like emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, bullying, all of those things.
Financial, yep.
Okay. So I think a lot of people don't know that. Like, I don't think people are aware of all the ways the victimization could potentially play out. Are there opportunities for caregivers of autistic kids to help build those kind of like, if the spidey sense isn't kicking in, right, the interoception, are there ways to build those while allowing for kids to still be their authentic selves in the world?
I think maybe in terms of stories, that comes to mind, reading books, telling stories where maybe one person wasn't acting kindly towards another person and what were the signals, because kids learn a lot from stories and from play, acting things out, all of that sort of thing. It's not in one conversation or one technique, but many, many conversations.
One of the things that we think a lot about is what not to say to people, to the kids themselves. This comes up around sexual orientation, gender identity. What are some things that you wish people would stop saying to autistic kids about autistic kids? Like Emily Ladau, who wrote a wonderful book called Demystifying Disability, has like columns of like what to say, what not to say. Do you have any that come to mind for you that you'd love to kind of educate our listeners about?
Oh, that's a good question. One that just ran through my mind is, you're so sensitive, right? And as an ADHDer, I got that one growing up all the time. And it just, every single time, it made me feel less than. It made me feel so inadequate. And I internalized it over time to truly, you know, at 58 years old, successful by any metric, I still fight that feeling that I'm too sensitive and that it's not my nervous system, but a character flaw. I fight that every
day. It's so damaging to kids. And these kids are sensitive. They have sensitive nervous systems. They're sensitive to the external world. They're sensitive to the internal world quite frequently. That is not a character flaw. That's their nervous system. So I'm sensitive to the phrase, you're so sensitive.
Yeah, mine is don't be so dramatic or calm down. I'm like, if I had a dollar for every time. But I think helping kids understand that it is their nervous system, it doesn't make them a bad person or a good person. It just, that's how they're wired. I think it sort of neutralizes the judgment because kids love the science. Like they love understanding how people's bodies work. And I like that language a lot as a way of kind of a non-judgmental way of framing it.
Right, right. And in fact, when you actually understand that you were born with a sensitive nervous system, then you realize, oh, I'm not, quote, too sensitive. I'm actually really strong. I'm stronger than most people, right? I move through a world that is, as one patient said to me recently, loud, sharp, and pointy. She said, the world is just loud, sharp, and pointy. And I think that there's a real strength there. And to recognize that strength is very powerful.
I mean, in much the same way that we tell kids who are allergic, your immune system is simply too good. I mean, and that's the truth, right? They go to 11. In many ways, that's what you're describing here. And it is true. These are, you know, I'm so glad we're moving away from the medicalization of all of this and talking about the spectrum of behavioral and social and experiential circumstances for kids and adults who live with autism. And it's a wide-eyed look at not just non-judgmental, it's like a beautiful, inclusive, excited to bring you into our fold in whatever way works for you view. And I think all of our listeners are so fortunate to have your perspective. Donna, thank you, thank you, thank you for sharing your work and your world and your experience with all of us. I know there will be lots of follow-up in terms of questions and conversations, and we look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Fun conversation. You guys have asked great questions.
Thank you, Donna. We absolutely love hearing your feedback and getting all your questions. So anytime you want to be in touch, email us at thepubertypodcast@gmail.com. If you're looking for great puberty products like the Oom shorts or the Oom socks or the Oom bra, you get the theme there, go to myoomla.com. If you want more content, you love what we do on the Puberty Podcast, and you want to have us come speak or learn more about our book or subscribe to our amazing newsletter, The Awkward Roller Coaster, go to orderofmagnitude.co. Remember, it's .co because we don't have enough money to buy .com. Yet.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.